study guide?
No.
Or is it also?
No. The study guide is the lectures.
Lecture notes?
I used to do that. I used to have like study sessions and stuff like that. And then it turned out people thought that that was a replacement for the course. So this way I feel like let people study for the course as we do it. If you have questions, you should feel perfectly free to ask. Okay. Today we're going to be talking about the second half of the 1920s and the first half of the 1930s. Really an extraordinary period in the history of international politics. What's our goal here? I just want to remind everyone what we're trying to do. We're not looking at the history just as an end in itself, just because it's very interesting, even though it is very interesting. Looking at it through a certain set of lenses. We want to use the history as a way of getting insight into these fundamental theoretical issues, the issues that define the whole field of international relations as a distinct field of intellectual inquiry. Right? And the basic method here is to note that certain general approaches to international relations, general ideas about how international politics is to be understood. There are certain affinities between those theoretical perspectives and particular historical interpretations. It follows from that by examining the historical interpretations closely in the light of the evidence, we can get some insight into the theoretical issues that are associated with them. Okay. Now, there is a particular historical interpretation of the interwar period that was very common in the immediate post-war period and still has a certain resonance that persists to the present day. What is this idea? The idea is simple. It's like, you want to understand the Second World War? It's simple. One word answer, Hitler. Hitler caused it. Wars are caused by aggressors. In this case, who could be more aggressive than Hitler? And you don't have to delve more deeply into the subject, right? And that separates itself from the realist view. The realist view is these. You know, it's not like Hitler is devoid of all importance, but there are these fundamental structural problems. Problems having to do with the unstable structure of power. Here you have Germany, intrinsically the most powerful country in Europe, artificially kept down by these Versailles constraints. There's a natural conflict between Germany wanting to throw off those constraints, the shackles of Versailles, the Germans called them. And the victor powers, especially France, that wanted to maintain these things because once the Versailles system collapsed, Germany would be free to build up its power, and then Germany would overwhelm France. France would become basically a satellite of Germany, forced to live in the shadow of German power. The problem is built into the very structure of things. You can't say one side is the aggressor, the other side is the victim. Right? Now, the first view, the more liberal view, insists on a sharp line of demarcation between the 1920s and the 1930s. 1920s? Oh, yeah, well, in the immediate post-war period, there were all these troubles, all these disputes between Germany and the West. But by 1925 or so, the middle of the decade, they had worked these things out. They realized that they had a common interest in going beyond all the passions of the war, moving past the kind of hostility that had produced the war to begin with, that was not in anyone's interest. They realized that they had to be good Europeans and put the interests of all of Europe as a whole above the interest of their particular nations, the kind of nationalism that had, caused all these problems was dépassé. And so people who came to power, especially in France and Germany, that were willing to make a fresh start and put all the recriminations behind them. They were good Europeans. They were interested in just reaching accommodations, understandings with each other, which would make a new war impossible. Right? There's a policy based on understanding. Right? And the idea was, yes, they were able to make this fresh start. The great symbol of this was the Locarno Treaty, or actually it was a set of treaties, but the most important of the Locarno Treaties was the treaty between Germany and the Western Powers. I'll be talking about this later because this is very important. The Locarno Treaty, Germany voluntarily accepted the new status quo in the West. Everyone agreed to live with things essentially as they were voluntarily. It seemed like there was now hope for a stable international order in Western Europe, that the West Europeans could now be on relatively friendly terms with each other, that power politics would no longer occupy center stage. The German foreign minister in this period, the man who dominated German foreign policy in the second half of the 1920s, during the Locarno period, his name was Gustav Stresemann. Yeah, I wrote it down for you there. He and his French counterpart, Aristide Briand, and Austen Chamberlain, the British foreign minister during this period, foreign secretary actually, they won a Nobel Peace Prize for what they had accomplished. You know, it really seemed like, you know, a new world was dawning, right? And people take this, at face value, then they explain the disasters that followed a decade later as just not built into the structure of things, instead a product of the Depression, and the Depression brought the Nazis to power in Germany in January of 1933, and the coming of the Nazi powers to Germany, it just ruined everything. You know, it just, here Europe was on the verge of, you know, a stable peace, and now that was no longer possible. All right, so that theory, that historical interpretation, has a certain affinity with these notions from you find in the international relations literature about what's really important in international politics. Is it, are wars to be understood in terms of aggression, pure and simple, or they to be understood in structural terms? Right? Is there, if it's structural, one would expect a high degree of continuity over time. If it's not structural, one would expect dramatic transformations over time, ruptures over time, as new people moved into positions of power. So we can get at this issue by looking at the history. And what do you find when you look at the history closely? Okay. Well, there's this conflict, we talked about this a lot, between France and Germany over the Versailles system. Would these constraints on German power remain intact? The Germans were revolting against the system, they wanted to throw it off. The French were unwilling to just give the Germans what they wanted. Ultimately, the upshot there was the Ruhr occupation, the Ruhr crisis of 1923, the great test of strength between France and Germany, the great test of whether the Versailles system would remain intact or whether Germany would once again reemerge as the number one power in Europe. And we saw how the Ruhr crisis ran its course, and how the French, in effect, snatched a defeat from the jaws of victory in 1923, and how France did not get its way. How instead the British and the Americans intervened. The key episode there was the Dawes Plan of 1924. And the French agreed that they wouldn't use force against Germany to compel German compliance with the provisions of the treaty regarding reparation. And the right-wing government was thrown out, and a left-wing government came into power in French elections of 1924 that took a much more moderate line. France's freedom of action is strikingly constrained in the post-war period, 1924 on. But this did not mean that Germany now had carte blanche, to move ahead and build up her military power, and once she became strong, to change the status quo, to, just revolt against the Treaty of Versailles, no holds barred. In fact, German policy is also constrained. This is what's quite interesting about this story. Because the stabilization that took place in the economic sphere, the new mark that came into being, that was now tied to gold at a fixed exchange rate with the other currencies that were tied to gold, this limited German freedom of action, because the Germans needed to retain the confidence of investors, especially in the United States, so that the Germans would be able to continue borrowing a lot of money from the West to kind of which Germany needed to do in order to cover the gap between what she was importing, what she was exporting, because if that flow of capital dried up, the Germans wouldn't be able to maintain the mark at its existing parity. They would have to devalue. And that was very difficult politically, in internal political terms, for the Germans, because devaluation was associated with inflation. And the inflation of the early 1920s had just been so traumatic for the Germans. It meant that all of your savings of a lifetime, vanish overnight, pretty much. So the Germans couldn't pursue a policy of just opposing the Treaty of Versailles across the board. They had to pursue a more subtle policy. And this is the policy that's associated with the German foreign minister, Stresemann. What were his aims, and how did he propose to go about achieving them? Two tests, the goals and then the methods. With regard to goals, his goals were fairly clear. He was not happy with the status quo. He was determined to dramatically alter the status quo. And what did he want? Well, number one is you got to build up German power, which means Germany needed an army that was capable, first, of defending itself, and second, once it was capable of defending itself, then to be used for offensive military purposes. Not that you necessarily want a war, but you want the structure of power to be such that you can achieve your aims without even having a war. So what do you want? You want to get back the Polish corridor in Danzig. You want to get back all of Upper Silesia that was lost to Poland. Right? Not just that, you want to get the rump state of Austria, German-speaking part of Austria, to be annexed to the German Reich. You want the German-speaking areas and the fringe of Czechoslovakia, living in the Sudeten Mountains. That also would become part of the German Reich. You have these territorial changes. Germany is going to outnumber France like 2-1, given the vast increase in German population following these annexations. And then, not only that, you're not even going to accept the loss of Alsace-Lorraine as permanent. Eventually, Stresemann wanted to get Alsace-Lorraine back. Right? This is the pan-German program from the period of the First World War. Stresemann is a German nationalist, pure and simple. How do you go about achieving it? By shouting from the housetops that this is what you want to achieve? Oh, of course not. You want to, in Stresemann's language, use this German term, finanzieren, to finesse. You want to finesse these issues. You want to kind of play along with the Allies. They're big believers in peace and being good Europeans, the League of Nations and so on. You play along with all that stuff. You tell them what they want to hear. Because if you calm their nerves, then they'll be more willing to remove the constraints on your power semi-voluntarily. Okay? to a certain extent, you got to play along. On the other hand, you don't want to foreclose the instruments of power politics either. And so you have, in the international sphere, German policy of not simply aligning itself with the West, but rather balancing between the Western powers on the one hand and Soviet Union on the other hand. You know, the Germans have a term for the Schaukelpolitik, they call it. This policy of playing off between East and West, balancing between East and West, threatening the West that if you don't give us what we want, we'll move closer to the East, threatening the East, if you don't give us what we want, we'll side with the West against you. You balance off between East and West as a way of getting benefits from both sides. Now, I should say, this is not simply a construct that historians came up with, you know, out of their own heads. The Germans were actually analyzing things in those terms at the time. I remember my very first paper in graduate school in 1967, this was on the post-Locarno period. And these two volumes of documents just came out, the British documents on this period and the German documents on this period. And I was just amazed. You read these German documents, they're arguing these things out in a very explicit way. There's this big debate that's conducted in the German Foreign Office. There are these three schools. There are the Easterners, headed by their ambassador in Moscow, Count von Brachtow-Franzau, his name was, who says, we should form a common front with the Soviets and revolt against the treaty. We have common interests with them. We have a common interest in destroying Poland, for example, common interest in opposing the Versailles system. And then there were the Westerners, and here the leader there was their ambassador in London. His name was von Hirsch. And he said, we have a common interest in joining forces with the Western powers so that there's no new conflict in the West. If we cooperate with them, they'll remove the constraints on our power voluntarily. They'll move towards treating us as equals. We don't want a new war. We have an interest as a bourgeois society in cooperating with the Western powers so as to defend European culture from the Bolshevik threat. All right. Those are the two wing arguments, but the prevailing argument, the dominant argument was, we don't want to align ourselves with either the East or the West. We want to play them off against each other. We want to pursue our own national interests by balancing between East and West. And this is what the Germans had been doing since the end of the war, right? They took very seriously the possibility of an alignment with Soviet Russia, much more seriously than the Western powers were willing to do. For Western powers, an alignment with Russia against Germany, you know, this was, you know, just out of the question. But for Germany, it was taken very seriously. An important treaty, everyone should know about this, the Treaty of Rapallo of 1922. To this day, it symbolizes Russo-German alignment, a Russo-German entente, that those two powers would come together. And the Locarno Treaty of 1925, which was between Germany and the Western powers and dealt with relations between Germany and Britain and France primarily, this was counterbalanced in 1926 by a neutrality agreement between Germany and the Soviet Union, the Treaty of Berlin. Right? So that's diplomatically the Germans had a certain course of action, and militarily their whole notion was, we have to build up our power secretly. Or at least, not in an overt way. Build up our military power. Not comply with the terms of the Treaty of Versailles. And this involved cooperation between the German army, the Reichswehr, and the Red Army, because the Germans and the Soviets could get a lot from cooperating with each other. The Germans could experiment in the use of new military technology, such as poison gas and tanks and so on Soviet territory when the West wouldn't know anything about it. And the Soviets could learn from the Germans about their new military thinking. About the Germans would help the Soviets build up their military power. Again, this is quite explicit. And this is from this a really good book on this stuff. If you're interested, by John Jacobson, it's called Locarno Diplomacy: Germany in the West, 1925 to 1929. And he quotes from Stresemann. He says, in Stresemann's opinion, it was Germany's failure to comply with the reparation clauses of the treaty which had led ultimately to the Dawes Plan. And in January 25, he expressed his confidence that further non-compliance would continue to lead to more negotiated settlements. Right? This is not someone who's deeply committed to the idea of burying the hatchet with the Western powers. Yes, for the time being, you'll play along with all this semi-pacifist rhetoric, and but Stresemann is not Adenauer. You know, the sort of policy West Germany pursued after World War II, policy of genuine accommodation with Germany's former enemies in the West, you don't find that in the late 1920s, although people believed that it was already there. Okay. The great symbol of this effort, at least on the part of the Western powers, to make a new start and put their relations with Germany on a much more stable basis, to achieve a kind of a permanent settlement, permanent peace, was the Locarno, the main Locarno Treaty of 1925. Now, what did this provide for? Everyone should know about what Locarno provided for. Actually, there was a set of treaties at Locarno. There were all these arbitration treaties, for example, between Germany and eastern neighbors, Poland and Czechoslovakia. But the Germans were very clear in pointing out that the treaties relating to Germany's eastern border dealt simply with legal and not with political issues. Germany was not recognizing as final the settlement in the East. With regard to the settlement in the West, however, it seemed the Germans were willing to go a lot further, and that disparity, even on paper, between what the Germans were willing to accept in the West and what Germany was willing to accept in the East is quite striking at this point. What did Germany agree to in the main Locarno Treaty called the Rhine Pact? Basically, stabilization of the status quo in the West. The status quo meaning not simply the territorial settlement, but the demilitarized status of the Rhineland. The Germans voluntarily now agreed to what had been imposed on them in the Treaty of Versailles, that the Rhineland would remain demilitarized. Okay? Germans wouldn't fortify it. They wouldn't send troops into the Rhineland. Okay? On the other hand, the French would also accept the status quo. They wouldn't use force against Germany. So in other words, a repeat of the Ruhr occupation was out of the question, except in the case of a flagrant violation of the terms of peace, in which case the French would have to go to the League of Nations, get League of Nations consent to use force, etc., etc. In a very complex process, it essentially, for all practical purposes, locked France into the status quo. On the other hand, France wasn't going to use force to change the status quo anyway. Nor was Germany going to use force against France, and Germany was too weak at this point to remilitarize the Rhineland anyway. So you're stabilizing the status quo in the West. Everyone, the French, the Germans, the Belgians, agree to it, and it's guaranteed by two other powers. And which are those two other powers that are put in this position of the guarantors of the peace between France and Germany? Great Britain, formerly France's ally, now is taking this even-handed policy of between France and Germany, guaranteeing France against German aggression, which is not very likely for many years, but also guaranteeing Germany against French aggression, much more serious. But Britain isn't the only power. The other power is Italy, and we're talking here about fascist Italy, Mussolini having come to power in Italy in 1922. Right, so this is a major importance in terms of Italian prestige. Italy is right up there with Britain as one of the two arbiters of Franco-German relations. Yeah. It seemed that the peace had a genuine peace agreement had been reached, a true accommodation had been reached, but it meant a lot less than it seemed. Because it was one thing for Germany to say, we're not going to remilitarize the Rhineland when we're weak. But what about when Germany became stronger? Because it was clear that the Germans were building up their military power in secret. After the war, all sorts of German archives fell into the hands of the Allies, and in particular the victor powers. I'll get to you in a sec. And one of the big collections of these papers was the Stresemann papers, the Stresemann archive. And there was a very interesting scholar. He was an emigre from Germany, not Jewish. He was a Gentile. He had left because he couldn't stomach the Nazis in the 1930s. His name's Hans Gotzke. And he was the great specialist in Stresemann. He wrote a lot about Stresemann. And he discovered that not only was Germany rearming in secret, but this was part and parcel of the basic Stresemann policy. You know, this created quite a sensation at the time because there had been all this propaganda to the effect of, you know, there was this real chance for peace. The Germans really wanted to make peace with France in the late 1920s. You know, there was, you know, Stresemann, the good European, and so on. And it turned out all that stuff was just the tactic to kind of get Germany through the danger zone so that Germany could kind of move ahead and build up her forces. Let me get you. Yeah?
Why did they accept a lot more from the West?
Why did they accept what?
The arbitration treaty.
Why did they accept it? Because from Germany's standpoint, the fact that she was now had made peace meant that the use of force against Germany was no longer legitimate. Yeah?
Why more from the West than the Eastern border?
Why more from the West? Why was there more of a threat from the West?
Why did they accept a lot more from the Western border?
Because there was no threat to them in the East that compared to the threat that the French army on the Rhine posed to them. Who's going to threaten them in the East? Poland? Poland is very weak. And Soviets are weak, plus they're behind a hostile Poland. They would have to march through Poland to attack Germany. You know, if they did that, the Western powers would come to the aid of Poland. That protected Germany. Germans didn't have to worry about the East, their eastern border. They did have a certain concern about the West. They wanted to kind of decrease yet even further the probability that France would act against them in the event that Germany was, you know, nibbling away at the Versailles constraints. That's what the Germans did. The French knew about this. The French military intelligence, it's called the Deuxième Bureau, They were informing the prime minister and the foreign minister about how the Germans were cheating in the whole area of rearmament. And what was the French reaction? Well, Briand, the French foreign minister, he meets with Stresemann at a little town called Thuarie. Germany was now a member of the League of Nations and on the Council of the League of Nations, and so Briand and Stresemann had lunch together in a small country inn not far from Geneva called Thuarie, And Brion says, well, I get all these dossiers from our military intelligence telling me about how your army is in not respecting the disarmament clauses of the treaty, you know? It's like, but I ignore all this stuff. He says, I take these dossiers and I fling them into the corner of my office because I think that peace cannot be based on such things as forcing Germany to remain disarmed, right? That's the attitude that you find in the West. The Germans are not complying. The Germans are not playing along the way the Allies wanted. Allies, that's, you know, it was all this talk about Locarno is just the beginning. But that whole notion was understood in radically different ways by the two sides. For the French, the whole idea, and the British, the whole idea was Locarno's the beginning. Now the Germans are going to, you know, play the game, to use this British term. The Germans are going to put their nationalist objectives aside. They're going to commit themselves to bearing the hatchet with us, to having good relations with us, to having a stable peace in the West. And when that happens, when the Germans have revealed that they're, you know, really good people and the kind of people that we could relate to on an equal basis, then we'll dismantle the Versailles system and relate to them as full equals. The Germans say it's a beginning. Now that they have their security guarantee, there's no justification for any of these constraints on our power. You know, we don't have to pay any further price to them to get them to dismantle the Versailles system. And if they're not going to give it to us, well, we're going to kind of take it. Not in a totally flagrant way, but in a gradual way, nibbling away on the Versailles constraints. So despite the fact that the Allies knew the Germans weren't complying with the disarmament provisions, and especially they knew about what the Germans were doing in Russia, still in 1927, the Allies removed military control from Germany. Germans are a lot freer now. With the removal of the Allied control commissions, the Germans are a lot freer now to move ahead with their rearmament. And don't forget, once Germany has armed up to a certain level, France really won't be able to use force against them. And once the possibility of French action against Germany is neutralized, then there's nothing really to stop Germany from building up such military power that she could then use military force as an instrument of coercion for changing the territorial settlement. Yeah.
So why did Brienne decide not to really do anything if he knew that Germany was rearming?
What's his choice? Good question. Everyone hear the question? Why did the French go along with this? Why did the French accept this? When they knew that that essentially the Locarno policy had failed, right? Here's a guy, he wins the Nobel Prize for achieving this great peace settlement, and then he's going to come to his own people and say, the whole thing was a sham, it was a fraud. You know, it didn't work. They're locked into it because there's no alternative. What's the alternative? Going back to the Poincaré policy, the use of force? Bankrupt, discredited. So hoping against hope that this is just a German neurosis. Their kind of nationalist anger had been so stirred up by what had happened during the war and in the early post-war period. They'll get through it. They'll settle down, and then they'll realize how important it is for them to have good relations with us. It's a hope. There's a wonderful saying from Lord Salisbury, who's the greatest British diplomatist of the late 19th century. He said, the commonest error in politics is sticking to the carcasses of dead policies. And this is so true of this period of the late 1920s. I mean, I love that quote because it's like one of these one-size-fits-all quotes that you apply it to practically anything. But he applied it, but applies it with tremendous force to the spirit of the late 1920s. There's no alternative. You know, they're not going to voluntarily admit to the bankruptcy of the policy that they had pursued because they can't see what else they can do. It's this hope that, well, you know, the Germans will eventually understand the importance of good relations with the West. They'll calm down. And so they continue along this route. 1927, removal of military control. 1930, the French occupation forces are withdrawn in their entirety from the Rhineland. Right. All these things make it easier for the Germans to rearm. Withdrawn well ahead of schedule. And then, especially December 1932, the Allies issue this declaration agreeing to the fundamental German demand for equality of rights in matter of armament. The Germans would have the same right to rearm as the Western powers did. It's the German term for this is Gleichberechtigung, equality of rights, an important slogan of the Germans during this period. Right, you don't have to know these German words. okay, December 1932, what's important about this? What happens the very next month? Hitler comes to power in Germany, January 33. What this means is, before Hitler came to power in Germany, the Versailles system is already dead. It didn't take Hitler to destroy it. It had already collapsed. Before Hitler came to power in Germany. Before the Depression even struck. You know, the Great Depression, ushered in by the stock market crash in late 1929. You know, really hits Europe and the United States in 1930. Before the Depression even struck, the French realized that the whole thing had failed. The relations between France and Germany had really deteriorated sharply. This is a nice sentence from a French journalist from this period. He says, "When friends quarrel, people say it's because of a misunderstanding. In reality, it's because a misunderstanding is being cleared up." And that's what happened here. A misunderstanding was being cleared up about whether the Germans were reconciled to the post-war status quo. Okay. What's the proof? What's the proof that the French recognized that the whole effort had failed before the Depression struck, let alone before Hitler came to power? They decide in 1929, before the Depression, to build a great line of fortifications across northern France. This is the famous Maginot Line. If they thought peace had been established, why would they have needed to do something like that? Extremely expensive. Okay, 1929. These dates are very revealing, because of the bearing they have on that central issue that we're concerned with here. Namely, is this stuff to be understood in structural terms, or is it to be understood in terms of personalities? How sharp a dividing line is there between the 20s and 30s, between the Locarno period and the Hitler period, between Stresemann and Hitler? And the thrust of the historical evidence is that line is a lot blurrier than we had been led to believe. Gotzke, in one of his articles that deals with this whole issue of continuity, he actually quotes Hitler talking about Stresemann. And Hitler says, "Well, of all my predecessors, he," meaning Stresemann, "was not the worst." And Gotzke's comment is, "Faint praise perhaps, but still remarkable considering the source." Right? There are these fundamental structural problems that had not been resolved. The period of the late 1920s was more a period of illusion than a period of, you know, genuine hope. The Germans were trying to make their way through a danger zone when there was still a risk of intervention against them, when they were still too weak to defend themselves against a military intervention on the part of powers that sought to maintain the system. Yeah?
So if the French built the Maginot Line in 29, why did they evacuate the Rhineland in 30?
Well, they were part and parcel of the same policy. If you're going to evacuate the Rhineland, how are you going to protect yourself? Right? Evacuating the Rhineland and then eventual German remilitarization of the Rhineland brings the German forces much closer to you. And so you have to worry about these things. I mean, I can go into this stuff in greater detail. The key thing is, if you're making this kind of huge military investment, it means that you are not confident that the peace has taken root. And in fact, there are plenty of reasons to, if you were French, to fear for the future. You know, the Versailles system was unraveling before Hitler came to power. Very important point. All right. So structural considerations counted for a whole lot more than we had been led to believe. That whole theory about, oh, well, in the Locarno period, there was this genuine hope that France and Germany had buried the hatchet and that Europe had left the white water and had entered into the blue seas of perpetual peace. It turned out to be a mirage. It wasn't just an accident that things took a turn for the worse. Depression or no depression, Hitler or no Hitler, you would have still had this structural problem. Right? Now, what does this mean? Does this mean that Hitler made no difference whatsoever? Right. Obviously not. No one would ever say anything like that. Right. It just relativizes the importance of what happened beginning in January of 1933. Now, what was the importance of the Nazi Revolution? Twofold importance, again, in terms of ultimate goals, and second, how you go about achieving them. Right. The ultimate goals are much more far-reaching than anything you ever had under Stresemann. The ultimate goal is not just making Germany the number one power in Europe, Stresemann's goal, but using that power to achieve a vast German empire, a huge amount of land that would be settled by Germans, that would make Germany into a world power capable of standing up to any other power in the world, in fact, ultimately of taking on any other power in the world, you know, slaughtering the existing inhabitants of those areas, replacing them with Germans, right? How is, you know, this is what the Germans meant by the under the Nazi period, during the Nazi period, of creating living space, Lebensraum. Now, how is Lebensraum and all this stuff to be understood, the whole Nazi program to be understood? Very much a product of the social Darwinism of the late 19th century. And that social Darwinism of the late 19th century is very much tied in with the Darwinian revolution in scientific thinking. You know, this whole notion of the only thing that counts in evolution, including human evolution, because human beings are a biological species like any other, is reproductive advantage. There are no moral laws that constrain what happens. Well, the only test of whether something prevails or not is reproductive success. And anything that helps you achieve reproductive success, those traits then spread throughout the population because they lead to reproductive success. And as they spread throughout the population, they come to characterize the species. So violence is par for the course. There's nothing to constrain violence if it serves the reproductive interest of a species. Nay, a phrase of the Darwinians, what you have is nature red in tooth and claw, natural, normal. Now, the interesting thing about Darwinianism in the 19th century was that in most of the advanced European countries, those notions were limited to the non-human natural sphere. They were not transposed into the analysis of what went on in the human sphere, human evolution. You know, so much so that one of the historians of science who studied this stuff referred to this as the Darwinian non-revolution. You know, there's a people were very reluctant to take these Darwinian ideas and apply them to human relations, except in one country, and that country was Germany. The Germans were far more willing to buy into all this stuff and grasp the implications. And we're talking here not about, you know, Prussian Junkers and the most reactionary elements in the German society before World War I. We're talking about the most advanced elements in that society. People like the very famous intellectual Max Weber, you know, very much a believer in social Darwinism. And the whole Nazi philosophy was based on those notions. Now here's the kind of interesting thing about all this stuff. This whole political program was based on the idea that you needed land. Why? Because your population, especially if it's biologically successful, and the expansion of population, reproductive success, is the measure of fitness. In Darwinian terms, you need land to feed a rapidly expanding population. And Germany's population before the First World War was expanding very rapidly. Okay, and so the question was, how many mouths to feed? You know, how much food, how much land to produce it. You needed land to, provide for all these, new mouths that had to be fed. All right. The interesting thing is that was an illusion. It was an illusion for two reasons. One reason was that if you look at the demographic statistics for the first half of the 20th century, especially for Germany, you're struck by the fact that decade after decade, through war and peace, through depression and prosperity, the picture is the same. The German death rate and the German birth rate both fall, but the German birth rate falls faster than the death rate, which with the result that population growth levels off. And this we've seen in the entire world. It's like one of the great dramas of the current world, what's going on demographically. But it was true in Germany. The rate of increase of the German population was slowing decade after decade. The other important point is that food production, agricultural productivity, the ability of a given amount of land to generate food, this is growing by leaps and bounds in the 20th century. A lot of it has to do with the fact that a process is developed that allows you to take nitrogen from the air, because the air is four-fifths nitrogen, and construct, artificial fertilizers, which just increase how much food a given amount of land could yield, and dramatic changes in the quality of the seeds that are used, and so on and so on. So a lot of this stuff, the whole social Darwinist philosophy was based on these two fundamental misconceptions. It was nonetheless real in terms of what people believed.
Is this specifically in Germany?
In Germany, it's by far more extreme than it was in other countries. You had social Darwinism in Britain, in France, in America, but nothing like the extent that you had in Germany. You know, the whole Nazi thing, it looks to us as just this garish, nightmarish thing, but it has to be understood in a specific historical context, right? All right. Hitler comes to power with this way of looking at things. How does he proceed? Full speed ahead? A violation of every single provision of the Treaty of Versailles, one after the other? No. Again, he understands that Germany has to go through a danger zone. That the Germans themselves are amazed that the French don't launch a preventive war against Germany in 1933. How could it be, given how overt the Hitler philosophy was, and he laid all this stuff out in this book, Mein Kampf, translated into French and English? Why is it that people sit on their hands and do it? Well, still they're afraid that there's a certain risk that the French will awaken from their torpor and do something. So they feel like they have to adopt the kind of diplomacy that minimizes those risks. Which means Hitler talks about his, deep craving for peace and limited goals, and he surrounds himself with representatives of the old German elites in the Foreign Office, and he makes a non-aggression pact with Poland, and he has a concordat with the Vatican, and all these things give the new German regime a certain degree of legitimacy and so on, and can't we just work these things out diplomatically? And so meanwhile, the Germans are beginning to rearm. On the part of the Allies, there's little they could do about it because they don't have the military means to deal with Germany, especially given the effect of the Depression. The Depression shrinks the level of economic activity, therefore shrinks tax revenues, but increases the demand on the state's resources because you can't allow the unemployed to just starve. You have to support them. And there's little left over for military purposes. So what are they going to do? Plus, there's a sense of, we can't use force against the Germans because the Germans are as neurotic as they are, because of the way they were mistreated and the fact that we had used force against them. We're going to have to ride this thing out and just hope for the best, right? So gradually, Hitler feels his way through. It takes the thing one step at a time. First, you build up, the German army domestically. 1935, they announced the reintroduction of conscription. They announced the fact that Germany now has an air force. Very little in the way of reaction on the part of the West. And then 1936, the key step, the remilitarization of the Rhineland. Clearly a violation of Locarno. And the remilitarization of the Rhineland marks the transition from the cautious phase of Nazi foreign policy to a much more active phase. And just one look at the map, you can see why that would be the case. Because once you can defend yourself in the West, you have a much freer hand to just move full speed ahead with rearmament and then to use that new military power to put pressure on the East, and there's little that the Western powers could do about it. So that's where I'll take up the story next time. The remilitarization of the Rhineland, March of 1936, and take it down to the outbreak of the war in September of 1939.